Kid is 3 years old. Ready for the midst of census. Kid is 3 years old, ready for the midst of census. And he gets up on the chair at the party. He makes a bracha, puts on tzitzis, everyone's excited, everyone claps, you have the tzitzis, the puff paint, the mitzvah train on it, everyone's excited, we have a cake, we sing songs, Baruch Hashem, lots to celebrate. Little to celebrate if a decade or several down the road, the kid is 13, 23, 53, still wearing the size 3 tzitzis, which by now are choking him around the neck. It's obvious that the physical aspects of our emotion have to grow with us. Less obvious and more critical that the spiritual, emotional, mental, intellectual aspects of emotion have to grow with us as we get older. More critical, but less obvious. You can't get away with wearing this size 3 tzitzis forever. You could get away, inertia will carry you through life with a 5-year-old's understanding of Avraham Avinu and a 7-year-old's understanding of Shmona Esrei, unless you make a conscious, deliberate effort to re-examine it as you grow older and more mature. And Megillas Esther definitely fits into that category. Because Baruch Hashem have had the blessing of having been exposed to Megillas Esther from a young age, but that blessing carries with it a potential cost, which is you could forever have a 6-year-old's understanding of the Megillah. And the Megillah is certainly meant for 6-year-olds, but certainly was not only meant for 6-year-olds. And Purim B'chlal suffers from that a little bit. Many people have the misconception that Purim is a children's holiday. Definitely children can enjoy it, and children maybe have an easier time enjoying Purim than enjoying Shavuos, but Purim is not only for kids. Purim is easier access for more people, but you have to make sure that as you grow older and more mature and more sophisticated, that the sophistication is not only in the Ksais and Briskerov, which you could not have even imagined when you were 6 years old that you understood, but in the Megillas Esther and the Bereishis and the Shmona Esrei, which you, when you were 6, you had an appropriately 6-year-old understanding of those things. But as you grow older, you have to make sure that your appreciation of them grows older. But I'm looking forward to spending some time focusing on the Megillah the next few days. I actually want to start with the first parak. We neder, which I will have time later in the week to look at sort of the core story of the Megillah going forward. But the first parak itself raises interesting questions. The first parak is the party. The Megillah says to the Chalal, the first parak for Frosh. The Gemara actually has the Mishnah has a machlokas. The three machlokas had tanav. Where do you start the mitzvah of Mikra Megillah? Everyone agrees to what the text of the Megillah looks like, but not everyone agrees you have to lay all of the Megillah. There's a mitzvah of Mikra Megillah, but there most opinions in tanav how you start later, either from the introduction of Mordechai or from the introduction of Haman. But we possibly start from the beginning, the introduction of Ahasuerus, which really raises a question based on another Gemara in Megillah. A question not only about Mikra Megillah, but about Tanakh in general. Because the Gemara tells us that Nevuah Shehotzer Chalodaros Neftino, Nevuah Shehotzer Chalodaros Lo Neftino. Gemara says that there are astronomical numbers of Nevi'im, over the 1,000 years of Jewish Nevuah, from Moshe to Malachi, astronomical numbers of Nevi'im. The Gemara puts out the number Pi Shinaim Kiyotze Mitzrayim, 1.2 million Jewish Nevi'im. It's clear in the Tanakh there were periods of time when there were very few Nevi'im. There were periods of time when there were more Nevi'im. Versus there were so many Nevi'im. And so few of them appear in the Tanakh. Why? 48 Nevi'im, 7 Nevi'im. What happened to everyone else? It would
be a long Tanakh.
It would be an extensive Tanakh. They're all set. Over the course of 1,000 years, those Nevi'im all had Nevuah. That's a lot of Nevuah. So little bit makes it into Tanakh. Such a tiny... We look at Tanakh and say it's enormous. Almost 1,000 prakim. The truth is, it's tiny compared to what could be. The Gemara says, Sataka. Well, what's the criterion to decide what makes it in and what doesn't make it in. Apparently the bar is very, very high. Very few nevuahs make the cut to make it to Kisrei HaKodesh. What's the bar? The Gemara says, nevuah shalot shalot daras nechtava, nevuah shalot shalot daras lo nechtava. Nevuah was necessary for that generation. So it was said for, every nevuah was said for a reason, but the vast majority of nevuahs, 99.999% of nevuahs, were relevant for that dar, but not eternally relevant. HaKadosh Baruch Hu wanted that message to be conveyed to that person, to that group of people, to that generation, but that was it. So the nevuah was given, but it wasn't recorded in Tanakh. Everything recorded in Tanakh, the Gemara says, has eternal significance. Everything. Nevuah shalot shalot daros neshkevo. Nevuah shalot shalot daros lo neshkevo. That's a very specific bar. Now the Ralbad, among the Rishonim, is the one who's most explicit about using that. And if he's Perish, a Nevi Meksuvim, he'll stop every couple of prakim usually to say, after his pasuk interpretation, he'll say, okay, so what have we learned from the last few prakim? Or as he puts it, what are the to'alios? What are the usefulnesses? What are the objectives of the last couple of prakim of Nach? What were the lessons that we're supposed to learn in the Doros? Because the Gemara meant that they were serious. That's one of the basic methodological tools in our toolbox for learning Tanakh, is to look and see, after we've interpreted the psukim, take a step back and ask, so what's in it for me? Not in the core sense, but what am I supposed to learn from this? What's Tanakh teaching me? Fascinating history, fascinating messages. What's the message for me? Because every single line of Tanakh is nevuah shalot shalot daros. You look at the first paragraph of Esther. Again, many of us don't even look at the first paragraph of Esther because we just see how we listen to it. You begin to analyze, then you'll see, we're about to do that, when you break in a moment to find Chavrusas, or actually even by yourself, and by yourself is even better, and you'll have a brief few minutes, very brief few minutes, to take a peek at the first parak of Esther. There are a number of, but you'll actually look at it analytically, and see how many questions you can find. What bothers you? For some of you, maybe the first time you actually looked at the first paragraph of Esther analytically. And all of a sudden, it was so a question, we're so used to hearing it, all of a sudden you begin to look at it with open eyes, a lot of details in the psukim that begin to bother you. And then there's also the larger question of why is it in the Megillah? Especially, as I mentioned before, several Tanam held the only regret, it's not part of the Mitzvah Mikra Megillah. You could start the Megillah from later. Which makes you wonder, not only why do we include, why do we hold this part of the Mitzvah Mikra Megillah, why is it in the Tanakh? Achashverosh made a party, he made another party. Ma'inyan lama, ma'achpat lama. He made a party. There are many historical events of significant historical interest at the time that don't make it into the Tanakh. There are nations that lived and were powerful forces in the ancient Near East during the period of Tanakh that aren't mentioned in Tanakh because the Nevuah shalot shalot daros lo nechtava. The historical chunks, the narrative parts of Tanakh are accurate, of course, true accurate history, but they're not complete. They're not meant to be because the Tanakh keeps telling us as one of the svarim where we hear this is in the Megillah. Say, oh, you want to hear the rest of the story? Look in the Sefer Divrei HaYomim, Amei Paros HaMandai. You want to get the full history? Look in the history books. This is not a history book. The Tanakh quotes, mentions historical events, but only mentions those events which have eternal moral relevance for us. It's not meant to be a full history. It's a moral retelling of accurate historical events. So there could be, there are nations that don't appear, there are events that don't appear. So the question is, well, what's the great significance of the first part? Later on, we'll talk about later on. But for now, the first part, why not start later? Mordechai, Esther, Haman, we'll get going. What's the great significance of the first part?